"You've gone a bit quiet, Cole," said Ulysses. "Fuck off, Birdbrain." On Friday, the 6th of August, at 4:30 p.m. and 24.4 seconds, Fanny won the 200 metres, and Cress quietened the snug and urged everyone to raise their glasses to Fanny. To her effortless stride and determination, to her 30 years, to her unassuming beauty, to her single-mindedness, to her... "What is it with him and this woman?" said Cole. "Search me," said Ulysses. "Bravery," said Cress. The glasses were raised. "To Fanny," they all said. "Three down, one to go," appeared on the blackboard. That evening, people passed by and shook Cress's hand. Wished him luck for the big race tomorrow, as if he was running a leg of the relay himself. A reporter from the Hackney Gazette came down to do a piece on him, which started well. Ulysses delivered a couple of pints to their table and heard Cressy say, "She'd already missed two Olympics because of the war, and most people told her to stay at home and look after the kids. Well, you tell me what's right about that kind of thinking." Ulysses stood out on the street. The evening was dreary, the promise of summer had deflated. If he won money, he thought, he might be able to get away or help Peg out, more like. Do something for the kid, buy a week of sunshine. Cress and the reporter came out onto the street fighting. "Course there's nothing unpatriotic in my support of Mrs. Blanker's Cohen," shouted Cressy. "Talent's talent, and you're a pillock." The story would never run. Ulysses went back inside to change a barrel. The following day was a Saturday. The clouds had pissed off to Hammersmith, and they were left with blue skies and a sharp sun, all show and no heat. People gathered around the pub as if a wedding was about to take place. The TV was warmed up, and Cole thought he was masterful charging entry. No one complained, though, and when old Cressy appeared, everyone in the snug cheered and led him to a chair at the front. Ulysses looked about for Peg. He asked Cole if he'd seen her, and Cole shook his head and called him a big old muggins, and hadn't he got the message by now. The front door clattered open, and Peg and Ginny and the kid rushed in, all flustered and sorries, just as the relay teams took their marks. The pub hushed. And at 4:40 p.m, all that could be heard was the sound of history in the making. Bang. By the time Fanny Blankers Cohen took the baton, she was 4 metres behind the Australian. Cole kept saying, "She ain't going to do it, ain't going to do it," and Ulysses could barely watch. Peg and Pete screamed, and the kid was up and down, and Claude had a run on droppings. But Cressy, well, Cressy stayed composed, with not a hint of sweat across his face. Fanny Blankers Cohen crossed the finishing line first, 47.5 seconds after the starter gun had fired. It was Fanny's fourth gold. Cressy was lifted into the air like a king, and 5 streets away, Tubby cursed and punched his oldest son in the face for having taken the bet in the first place. Cole sidled up to Ulysses and whispered, "How much do you think he won then?" "A bloody fortune," said Ulysses, "just to piss him off." How much old Cress had won became the stuff of legend and would be talked about long after the pub had gone. No one knew, not really, though speculators were many. Cress bought himself a pair of desert shorts off a veteran in the market, big baggy sandy things that he wore with a jacket and tie and sometimes a sleeveless sweater. As far as anyone could tell, they were his sole purchase after the big win. Everyone wondered what had happened to the rest. Those who had cheered him on months before soon succumbed to derision. Human nature, right? Of course, Tubby knew the amount. Tubby felt the pain of that loss every waking hour, and one day someone would have to pay. Tub sent a man out with a magic key to snoop about Cress's gaff, but Cress always knew because he could see air that had been disturbed by a stranger. Cress didn't know why he'd got all that money at his time of life. In truth, he thought it was too late for him to make the changes a younger man might have made. But he sat under his tree and listened. He admired his legs sticking out of his shorts, and he knew they were his best feature, because they were his mother's legs. Thoughts of his mother made him cry. 1950, and the turn of the decade was welcomed. Fuck off the 40s, what have you ever done for us? Cole lit the last of the fireworks that were to usher in a decade of hope. I mean, how bad can it be, he said, imploring the exploding heavens. Yeah, just you wait. British National Service conscripts were soon sent off to Korea, and absence and heartbreak were back on the menu. Ulysses joined Piano Pete to march against the war and got drunk in a Soho pub afterwards in a wordless show of grief. Kid had turned into a chatty little thing with a mouth full of American teeth, and she called Ulysses Ulysses and he called her Kid. Peg got promoted from the typing pool and she played it cool, but Ulysses could see that she was jazzed. Even one rung up the ladder, the air smelt fresher, the view wider. Cressy helped Ginny grow carrots and potatoes in the yard at the back of the pub, and she gave the first crop to Mrs. Corr, who had the convenience shop, simply because she liked her and the colour of her skin. Piano Pete cut a lucky break in a West End show, a small but noticeable part. He played a frontier pianist with a drink problem. Only appearing in the first act meant he could still honour his obligations to the pub. Beginner's tap class, though, could go fuck itself. Cole swapped Denise for Elaine, but in the end she didn't last long. Set his sights instead on a 1930s ambulance, because he'd always wanted one, ever since the day he'd watched his mother driven away in one. Geez, said Peg, I only ask. Heat grew that first summer of the decade, made the oldies wobbly and the dogs mad. Queues for the swimming pool extended along Whiston Street, but down by the canal kids were bombing in as kids do, getting a gutful of rat piss, but it was worth it, if only to feel a slight breeze on wet skin. Peg called out to Ulysses. He looked up and waved. She clacked down the steps and joined him on the bench. They watched the kids in their undies, skinny arms and legs flailing in the air, squealing and daring one another, and cascades of water splashed across the towpath onto their legs and shoes, but they didn't flinch or care. We did that, he said, adjusting his hat. Not that long ago, he said. Peg sighed. Another world, he said. As teenagers, they'd made out in the bushes to their left, oblivious to the stink of dog shit and the discarded French letters. She was his first. He wasn't hers, but all of them had borrowed one another to get good at it and to feel good. Pale skin in the moonlight. Peg was the keeper of their history. She knew the names of those long dead and who had done what and who had loved who. Not a care in the world, said Ulysses. What a strange thing to say, thought Peg. She'd never been without a care in the world. Not at that age, not at this age. A whirling dynamo of tension she was, and always had been, propelling bloods and lipids along a never-ending, godforsaken circuit. She remembered him as a boy. Stocky and small, with the brightest eyes, constantly polishing a silver lining. She used to give him blowjobs just to see his gratitude. Over time, he filled out. Got forearms all the girls went wild over, and his eyes got more blue, and his parents died, and he made globes and spun them on his middle finger, and he said, I want to be somebody someday, Peg. What'd you say? But what could she say? Someday was too far away. She bent down and adjusted her shoe. She said, I've met someone. Ulysses turned to her, said, Oh, yeah? Turned back to watch the kids. I think it's serious. He nodded. I'm taking it slow, just wanted you to hear it from me. Thanks, Peg. She stood up. She studied him. Always him. They needed to stop having sex, he told him so. Not fair on Ted. Ted your bloke, is he? And she nodded. Okay, he said, but he knew they wouldn't. Can I take Alice to the gallery tomorrow? He said. Of course you can. Morning, all right. All day, if you want. He laughed, but he knew she was serious. You're a good mum, Peg. No, I'm not. But it's good of you to say so. Your mum was a good mum, Temps. That's what a good mum is. Mine was competition. The next day, the Whitechapel Gallery felt cool out of the sun. Alice ran on ahead and scanned the paintings because she knew what she was looking for. She settled eventually on an area of floor where she'd be left undisturbed. She opened her sketchbook and took the pencil sharpener out of her sock. Ulysses knelt down. He collected the shavings in his hand and put them in his pocket because that was his job, and for an hour and a half, out of the corner of his eye, he watched the kid produce her own version of a painting by Joan Eardley. Children sitting on a pavement reading a comic, a world she understood. She was 5. Would she remember that moment as completely as he saw it? Probably not. But she would remember the day because years later she would tell people about it. The cool of the floor on her bare legs, the lines she'd made on the page. She would remember how a morning became an afternoon, how people stared at the paintings on the wall and talked about them in serious tones, how the gentle murmur became white noise and calmed her, how Ulysses' gaze made her think she was something or something enough, how she was glad to be away from her mother, how she saw a woman dressed as a man and thought how interesting life could be, might be, the type of day that showed her where she ended and the world began. Ulysses left the kid drawing. He wandered through the hall of paintings. Sheila Fell, Ava Frankfurter, Dorothy Cunningham. Since his conversation with Evelyn during that long, dark drive back to the albergo, he'd thought about the gallery a lot. How Evelyn had laughed at the snobbery of art, said that the responsibility of privilege must always be to raise others up. Standing there now, he equated that conversation with the space around him. Paintings by local schoolchildren were exhibited on the wall opposite, and he thought maybe this was what she'd been talking about. Nearby, an artist began talking about her work. From the back, the woman could have been a man with her short hair, rolled up shirt sleeves and high-waisted slacks, but her voice was unmistakably feminine. She was referred to as Miss Cunningham. Dorothy Cunningham, he presumed. He was drawn to the rounded explanation of her craft, her brow intelligent and open to the questions fired at her from the front. From considered to acute spontaneity, was how she described her new work. He let those words roll about his tongue. Ulysses looked over to the kid, still in her quiet world, sucking a pencil. The catch of conversation from a passing couple and a brief reference to Spain propelled him back to 1938, a year after his parents had died, and the year Picasso's Guernica came to the gallery. It had travelled the world by then, raising funds for the rebels fighting Franco. That's why Ulysses had gone to see it, his first ever exhibition, lured by a romantic and fallacious idea of war. The gallery had been a campaign headquarters of sorts, and price of admission, for those who couldn't afford the entrance fee, had been set at a pair of boots. He'd gone back the next day and left a pair of his father's just inside the doorway. On the leather tongue, he'd written, "Good luck." The voice of Dorothy Cunningham drew him towards the confluence of same thought, same time. "Yes," she said, "I did see the Guernica." A surge of electricity spluttered up his spine. "I agree," she said. "We learnt the hard way that there must always be a moral argument against the march of fascism." Ulysses wondered what his response to the painting might be if he were to see it now. "Not at all," said Dorothy Cunningham. "There was no heroism in Picasso's depiction of war, no victory, only horror. The deliberate bombing of civilians on market day," said Ulysses. Dorothy Cunningham turned towards him. "We weren't immune," he said. "It wasn't just them who did stuff. We did whatever it took too." Everyone looking at him. The kid looking at him. And it was this she would remember. His voice resonant in the stillness. People listening to him, not laughing. She stood up, marched over to him and held his hand. Her exquisite moment of ownership, the day when he became hers. They left the piece of the exhibition and were immediately consumed by the noise of the high street. Ulysses bought her a lemonade before they got on the bus.
"This is my best day ever," she said.
"There'll be more," he said.
"I know. I'm only 5.
That night, Peg watched the kids sleep. The face still flushed after a day out with Temps. Temps had a knack with her, but Peg couldn't come close. She sat on the bed and flicked through the kids' drawing book. She felt bad, like it was a diary, but not bad enough to put it down. A picture of Temps, a scar on his lip like a digit. The kid had talent, and she didn't get it from Peg, Eddie, of course. All the things she didn't know, like if he was dead or alive, or if he ever thought about her and their nights together. Cress had once told her she needed to tell Eddie things. Words of gold dust, that's what he'd said. So she told Eddie stuff. Stuff that would make her toes curl now. Laid out her heart on the bed and had cut it open, a full autopsy of love. That's what being in a hotel room could make a girl do. Sex in soft sheets and room service, making plans. And all the time, war was eavesdropping. Peg got up. She spilt gin on the bedclothes. Sometimes it was unbearable looking at the kid. The always reminder of the life she'd lost. April 1952 had old Cressy under his Prunus serrata, his Japanese cherry. It was evening and thick clusters of white and pink blossom hung heavy and low and reflected the flaming gold of a lowering East End sun. Cressy sat with a glass of stout from Coles and listened to the secrets of Mother Gaia. The voice of Ginny brought a smile to him.
What are you doing, Cressy?
I'm enacting the Japanese ritual of Hanami, my love.
Is that where you fold paper?
Not quite, sweetheart. Come sit with me.
And he got up and gave her his chair.
Rain,
she said.
Just starting, said Cressy, looking out. Won't last too long. Let's just sit it out, shall we?
Ginny nodded.
The smell,
she said.
Petrichor.
Ginny repeated the word over and over.
Scent of rain on dry earth,
said Cress, and he sipped his stout.
It won't go away,
she said.
Soon it will, my love, he said.
Miss.
What?
And Cress turned to her. She had tugged the top of her blouse away to reveal a small love bite, like a thumbprint, floating between her collarbone and breast.
Won't go away, Cressy.
Cressy smiled.
It'll go away, my love, if you cover it up and don't show anyone. You shown your dad yet?
Ginny shook her head.
Then don't. Best not to. It'll go away quicker if he don't see.
Thank you, Cressy, she said. Not scared anymore.
He bent down and held her cheek.
Good, he said. No need to be.
But Cress felt scared. He closed his eyes and felt the roots from his shoes stretch down into the dark, damp earth, past the dead and the Roman pots to the whisperings.
Rain stopped,
said Ginny. When Cress and Ginny came into the pub, Ulysses looked up and said, Alice is upstairs, Gin, and she ducked under the hatch and disappeared. Didn't expect to see you back so soon, said Ulysses. You all right, Cress? Cress nodded and placed his empty glass on the counter.
Meet me at the tree tomorrow morning, boy. Usual time. And bring Peg.
The next day, Ulysses was standing outside the pub, enjoying the sunshine and waiting for Peg. He raised his hand as she came around the corner, familiar little twinge in his guts at the sway of her walk. So what do you want to see me about, Tempy? She said. And before he could answer, a green ambulance, Red Cross and all, spluttered down the street.
Jesus Christ, she said.
He's brought it back from Swindon. Don't they scrap their junk there anymore? She said. Cole parked the ambulance outside the pub and was about to climb out when the siren suddenly wailed.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ, you piss bastard,
screamed Cole, hammering the dash. And there's the old Cole, thought Ulysses. The siren stopped. Cole closed the door gently behind him and crept over to them. What you think? He said. Speechless, said Ulysses. Peg? I won't be seen dead in that, Cole. No offence, but what you've got there is a charisma lobotomy. Cole looked hurt, but he didn't let on. He said, I'm taking Fionnuala out to Epping Forest tomorrow for a night in the woods. And Peg said, you turn up at hers in that, she'll think you're taking her out there to bury her. All right, he said. I hear ya. I'll invite her over to see it later this afternoon. Busting my balls, he said as he stomped into the pub. Peg slipped her arm through Ulysses and they walked on. "Notice how Cole's dating alphabetically," he said. "That's what you wanted to see me about," said Peg, and then she stopped. "Blimey, he is," she said. "Denise, Elaine, Finola." "G next," he said. They found Cress underneath the canopy of blossom, and a sudden intimacy enveloped them. Cress looked troubled. He kept his voice low and said, "Ginny's got a fella." And he told them about the love bite, and Peg said, "Christ, not again." And Ulysses said, "You sure it's not kids messing, Cress?" And Cress shrugged. "I don't know, boy. I just know she needs a bit of mothering." And the two men looked at Peg, and Peg swore because mothering wasn't her thing. The news about Ginny sunk Peg's mood, and she was a bitch to the kid all afternoon, no this and no that, and the kid kept a wide berth. Well, you would, wouldn't you? That night, the kid wanted her to read a story, and she held out The Little Prince, the book Ulysses had given her the week before. "And how am I supposed to do that?" Peg had asked him at the time, and he'd said, "It's easy, Peg. Just sit on the bed and you read out loud." So she sat on the bed, and the sound of her voice was clumsy and unconvincing, but the kid was entranced and eventually fell asleep. Peg read on. "Childhood breaks your fucking heart." The following evening, the ambulance set off for Epping Forest, trailed by a plume of Cole's aftershave. He'd made up the bed in the back and had packed a small gas stove and two tins of soup, tomato, and tea and milk for breakfast. Breakfast was his destination, and his balls were as heavy as a coal sack. It had been so long since he'd had a real woman, one who didn't feel sorry for him. The ambulance only got as far as Cressy's tree before the siren began to wail. Cressy looked out from under the blossom and saw Cole the colour of puce. Finola stared out of the window, face blank like a hostage. The evening light caught the wake from a canal boat, and gulls crested above the gasometers. Peg and Ginny held hands along the towpath, and to outsiders, those who didn't know, they could have been work friends, equals without a doubt. But a duck broke the illusion, and Ginny raced ahead, arms flailing, till the duck jumped back in the water. Peggy laughed. "Come here, Ginny, sit with me." Ginny sat. "How you doing, Gin?" "Happy. You, Peggy?" Peggy nodded. "Yeah, happy." She took a bag of crisps out of her bag and Ginny opened them, shooed away a curious pigeon. "Who'd you meet down here, Ginny?"
"I'm not allowed to come down here."
"I know that, but I know you do." And Peg leant into her and nudged her. "We all used to come down here. I had a boyfriend nobody liked, and I'd meet him down here, and we'd walk all the way to Islington. It was so dark under the bridges, just him and me. Sometimes I'd meet him at night, Ginny, and the feeling was the best feeling because I was escaping all the rules. And this fella, my boyfriend, he was older than me, and him being older made me feel older. Like I was in the world at last. The way he looked at me." Ginny listened. "I could make him do anything, Gin. Him all gaga over a schoolgirl. Never told me he had a wife." Peg took one of Ginny's crisps. "I know you've got a boyfriend too, Ginny." Ginny shook her head. "Yeah, you do. We were all told not to tell, but we've all gone through it. He nice to you, Gin? He kind?" Ginny nodded. "Is his name Travis?" "Travis? Why did that name come back to her?"
"No, silly," said Ginny,
and she got up off the bench and waved to a passing barge. She said something that Peg didn't catch so well, and Peg said, "Davy? Was that what you said? Is Davy on there?" she said, pointing to the barge. Ginny looked confused.
"No."
"What does Davy look like, Ginny? Is he like your dad or Ulysses?"
"No."
"Not like them at all?" She shook her head.
"Different."
"How different?"
"Stop, Peggy. Too tired."
Ginny leant down and rested in Peggy's lap. Peg stroked her hair.
"No blood anymore, Peg," she said.
"How long no blood, Gin?"
"Long time," she said.
Peg reached down and put her hand on Ginny's stomach. The bump was taut and slight under the billow of her dress. That night, Peg slept over at the pub. She was there the following morning with old Cressy and Ulysses when the ambulance turned the corner, siren wailing. Cole was alone in the front. He parked up and slammed the door. The siren died with the engine. "How was it?" said Ulysses. "Fuck off," said Cole as he walked into the pub. The other three followed him inside. Cole went straight to the optics. Two punches of gin straight down. "That bad?" said Peg. "I don't want to talk about it," said Cole. "Yeah, you do," she said. "I forgot the tin opener," he said. "The IV stand fell on her when we were getting into bed." "What IV stand?" said Peg. "Caught her just here," said Cole, pointing to the corner of his eye. "And in the middle of the night, what she thought was my toe was in fact a rat." "Christ," said Peg. "But it was the way she looked at me, Peg. That was the worst, as if I was the lowest form of life."
"A phylum porifera," said Chris.
"What?"
"A phylum. A phylum por..."
"Stop fucking saying the word phylum."
"That's the lowest form of life," said Chris. "A sponge."
"I don't think I could feel any worse," said Cole.
"Yeah, you could," said Peg. "Ginny's pregnant."
Pub closed due to unforeseen circumstances. Ulysses swept a path through the wreckage. Under his feet, the crunch of broken glass, and to his left, a pile of splintered chairs next to the hearth. The assault had been fast and furious and mercifully curtailed due to Cole's lack of fitness and high blood pressure. He'd fallen to his knees, panting and burping, as wave after wave of acid fell onto gastric shores. In the doorway, Ginny staring, a flash of insight into why her mother may have left. Ulysses picked up a table and set it on its legs. Walls of dust and blue feathers rose on a current of air. Claude had suffered another sudden molt that had left him with wing and tail feathers only. He was one of the innocents. So too was the stuffed stoat. An ashtray to the lower jaw had resulted in the mandible hanging literally by a brown thread. Ulysses lit a cigarette. Outside, the growing murmur of voices, mostly the old ones with an aggressive thirst on them. He looked at his watch. Pub should have been opened by now, and they'd been known to riot for less. He heard Mrs. Lovell say, "Unforeseen means unexpected," and then he heard, "Unexpected? What, death? Cole wouldn't close for death, unless Cole had died. What? Cole's dead?" Such was the derivation of rumour. Suddenly, a knock at the door. It was a pianist's knock, good rhythm, light touch. Pete's long face peering through the stained glass. Ulysses opened the door and ushered Pete in. Through the crack, he pushed Mrs. Lovell and her roast dinner back. "We'll be open this evening, Mrs. Lovell," he said. "I promise."
"Is Cole dead?"
she asked, relishing the role of spokesperson. "Not when I last checked," said Ulysses, and he closed the door, pulling the bolt across. Pete looked about gobsmacked. He said, "I was just passing when I saw the crowds outside. Cole have one of his turns?" "You know how it is." "You all right, Pete? Not bad, Temps. You?" "Not bad, Pete." And Pete followed him inside on tiptoe. "I don't want to touch anything in case I make it worse," he said. Ulysses carried the velvet stool back over to the piano. "I hate to ask," said Pete. "Miraculously untouched," said Ulysses. "Peg put herself between him and it. He had the poker raised above his head. 'Don't you dare, Cole,' she shouted. 'Don't you dare.' And she threw herself across the keys." "Joan of bloody Arc," said Pete. "What happened next?" It was like he was hypnotized. He dropped the poker, started to blink, and held his stomach. "And then what?" said Pete. "He fell to the floor, exhausted. Peg kick him?" "No, Pete, she didn't. She's up there with him now. He's sedated. Like a horse. Where's Cress?" "In the cellar, looking for stock. Most of the spirits took a pounding." Pete nodded, taking it all in. He sat down on the stool and lifted the piano lid. His fingers danced across the 12 major scales. "So," he said, cracking his knuckles, "what can I do for you, Temps?" "Something soothing, Pete. Of course, I know just the thing." And he lit the first of 2 dozen cigarettes. Ulysses was about to turn away when he said, "That's a lovely jacket, by the way, Pete."
this old thing. I've had it years.
All afternoon, the public bar of the Stoughton Parrot was tended to, and never was there a more grateful patient. Chopin's nocturnes steered the transformation, and Pete played with the same passion he'd mustered for his West End audition. Tables were hammered back into usefulness, and paintings were reunited with walls. The fire gorged on splintered wood, and soon a warm glow filtered into the space and took it away from death's door. Ulysses went out in search of more chairs, and he did four journeys of four each time. He brought down his dad's globe and placed it on the counter for Claude to use as a perch. Cress made beef and potato stew, and made enough for the evening punters too. Pete said Cress would have made a lovely life partner, and everyone agreed. Cress took Peg and Ginny and the kid out, and they came back with armfuls of cherry blossom. Must have hurt Cress, but he didn't let on. It'd have come to an arrangement with the tree. Kid and Ginny decorated the shelves with jugs of pink and white flowers, and Peg bandaged the stoat's jaw. And by 6:30 p.m., they all stood back in awe. They'd done it. The pub was ready to open. It looked wonky, but loved. And loved it had never been. With Claude on his shoulder and the stoat recumbent in his arms, Ulysses Temper stepped forward to open the pub, 5 minutes late for evening opening. Mrs. Lovell was first in the doorway. She looked him up and down and assessed the situation. "We're down but not out, Mrs. Lovell," said Ulysses. "You'll do," she said, and marched in. Through the doorway, Ulysses caught sight of Tubby Folgate's black Jaguar Mark V driving past, sniffing out trouble and weighing up the odds. "Didn't take long for word to get to him," thought Ulysses. Peg sat in Cole's room watching over him, her feelings stuck somewhere between rage and pity. But most women felt that way about Cole. Thank God in all the years she'd known him, she'd never ended up in bed with him. Small nurses. "Peg?" Cole stirred and pushed the blanket back. "Cole? How long have I been here?" "Days," she said. He sat up quickly. "Joke," she said, and lit him a cigarette. "Pub's open. No thanks to you. I should go down." "Not yet, you shouldn't," sound from downstairs. "I don't know what happened," he said, so Peg told him. "Ginny okay?" "I don't know, Cole. Is she?" "Peg. Is she pregnant, or is she so god-awful that you want her locked away, or shamed?" "Peg. Or shaken. You remember that? The shaking?" "Don't," said Cole, covering his face with his hands. "Touch of the deja vus, ain't it, Cole? Thought we'd turn that corner." "I just wanted to know. I still do," he said. "She won't tell you. She's frightened of him," he said. "She's frightened of you. Agnes all over again." Agnes said he destroyed everything he loved. Agnes said he'd be his own downfall. Agnes said. "So you tell me if she's okay," said Peg. Cole lay back down again, exhausted. "She's okay," he said. "Then love her again. You're all she has." "What am I going to do, Peg?" "First you go down and you tell him. Just tell him. This you can't hide, and you can't really ask if anyone knows anything. And if they don't, you let it go, and you don't do nothing stupid. You slay me, Peg." "Yeah, maybe. But I'm all you got." Peg didn't go down into the bar straight away, but watched from the doorway. She needed a breather of sorts, a lowering of the cortisol. Him pulling a pint was the balm, him and his parrot. She'd always thought the Tempers were a daft lot with their dimples and eyebrows and ears and their belief that life cuts you a break when you least expect it. She'd have done anything to have had a mum like Nora. Nora was all soft angles and kindness. Peg could be kind, but there wasn't enough of it to be a regular thing with her. It was like her wage always ran out by Thursday. She walked up behind Ulysses and held his arms, and he didn't turn around because he knew it was her. A dovetailed joint they were, they simply fit. She breathed him in, and he didn't feel the lightness of her kiss on his back. Claude saw it, though. Claude opened his beak as if to say something. Peg put her finger to her mouth. Our secret, she winked. At 8 o'clock, what they'd all been waiting for happened. Cole shuffled in, part invalid, part Old Testament, with a blanket draped around his shoulders and a moth around his head. He parted the silence like an ancient sea. He downed a gin and rubbed his forehead. Walked out to the centre of the room, all eyes on him.
Keep to the script, Cole, said Peg,
and he nodded. He cleared his throat and said,
Life tests us in many ways.
Pause. Ginny's pregnant. People looked at one another. A solitary gasp, a frown here and there, but generally it was the quiet absorption of information that filled the room, nothing more, nothing less.
I just want to know who's been missing, said Cole.
Silence.
You can tell me now or later, face to face or anonymously.
Silence.
Anyone?
Said Cole, voice rising.
Sit down now, Cole, said Peg.
Cole, said Peg sternly,
sit down.
Cole sat down.
It's like a bloody morgue in here, he said. And whose fault's that?
Said Peg.
Where's Pete? Said Cole.
In the bog.
What about a song, Peg? Forgive me for not quite feeling it, Cole. Temps, what about that magic trick, the one with the egg?
That wasn't me, Cole.
Pete walked back in, drying his hands. For fuck's sake, Pete, do something, said Cole. We're dying in here.
What Pete didn't know about an audience wasn't worth knowing. He closed his eyes and breathed in the muse. Unity was the word she gave him, strangely in a Northern Irish accent. The microphone crackled, the piano surrounded by a thick haze of blue smoke.
I'd like to dedicate this song to love, said Pete. I wrote it when I was in Yugoslavia.
When was Pete in Yugoslavia? Said Ulysses, leaning into Peg.
It's about regret, said Pete. It's called If I'd Known What I Know Now.
Hindsight, whispered Cress.
What?
Said Cole, twitching. Hindsight, said Cress. If I'd known then what I know now. That's hindsight.
Shut the fuck up, said Cole, and Pete began to sing. In the most unexpected way, a tincture of forgiveness bled across the dark night and entered the pub. From dusty corners looking out, ghosts of missed opportunities and held grudges and words unspoken were laid to rest. Spines straightened, joints eased, and hearts became light. Old Cress went somewhere deep inside himself, somewhere private, somewhere lush. Ulysses looked across the counter to Peg, and she turned to look at him, and their eyes locked in a serendipitous embrace, slow in motion. Cole had a glimpse of life on the open road, and his stomach settled. Suddenly Peg glanced towards the door, and there was Ted. Mr. Insurance, Mr. Risk-averse, who may or may not have a wife. Peg and Ted dancing now, Claude on Ulysses' shoulder, nuzzling his ear, Cress at the counter, spinning the globe like a roulette wheel. The front door opening as if caught by the wind, Tubby Folgate standing in the doorway like a Rorschach inkblot, lighting a cheroot, taken in the scene, swaying to Pete's mellow tune. The song came to an end, and how could it not have been a standing ovation? Pete had given his all. Peg was cheering, Ted modestly clapping, Cole whistling, but then, like the sudden tumble of dominoes, awareness shifted to Tubby, and the applause subsided, and Tubby said, Don't mind me, don't mind me. But they did mind him, and the room fell to silence.
Beautiful, said Tubby,
his glottal stop sharp as a blade. Tubby limped across the floor, lot of villain in that walk. The thick, reinforced boot on his left foot was custom-made by a cousin, the cobbler strand of the family going back generations and a rather pleasant lot in comparison. Tubby stood in front of Cole's table and slipped effortlessly into Cole's pain, his very presence a liberal salting. He blew out smoke and regarded Cole with his good eye, the one the loading hook hadn't taken all those years before.
I heard you got a bit of troubling, Mr. Formulo, he said. You need to talk, my man,
Not to you, you cunt.
Cole, Peg and Tubby looked over to the counter. Never had there been a more unfortunate moment for a parrot to regain his voice.